Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust, Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. You'll have to forgive me. I have a bit of a cold, so I have a little scratchy squeak in the voice, but we will sally forth and carry on. Today we'll be talking about DMT. DMT, the spirit molecule, the book by Dr. Rick Strassman, who we'll be talking to in the first half of the hour, and the new documentary by Mitch Schultz, who will be joining us in the second half of the hour as well. And it's always interesting, you know, thinking about the relationship between drugs and spirituality, because on the one hand, we tend to think of the spiritual as something that has nothing to do with our bodies, or at least only with the most rarefied and sublime aspects of mind and heart. And on the other hand, you have these molecules bouncing around a meat machine, and that's a very sort of, you know, carnal side of things. But of course, if you look at the history of religion, if you look at spirituality and mystical practices and you know, all of those techniques of deepening our connection with the all throughout history, you'll find many, many engagements with the pharmacopoeia of the world, with psychoactive compounds, both extreme ones like you know, ayahuasca, which contains DMT, and then more mild inebriants like wine and its relationship with Dionysus, and of course with the Eucharist in the Christian Mass. So there are these very interesting relationships between mind and molecule, but in a sense the claim that's being made, at least by some, for DMT is that it's in a particular class of its own. And it's a very interesting compound in the sense that it was known to have these profound psychedelic properties way back in the day, I think from the late 50s, actually. Some of the first studies were done in Eastern Europe, and it was part of the pharmacopoeia of the hippies in the 60s counterculture, but it didn't quite sort of make a mark on the society at large. Like when people think about the experimentalism of the 1960s, of course they think of LSD and marijuana and speed and, you know, even STP and things, but it's not really part of our cultural lore to think about DMT, even though it was very much there, at least in the more esoteric circles of freak experimentalists. And it really wasn't until the 1990s that it became kind of a cultural meme, partly through the works of Terence McKenna. And I remember being at a rave once in the early 1990s, and there was some kid with a DMT T-shirt. And, you know, I was very interested in researching these matters, reading about them, understanding the links between culture and consciousness. And so I went up to him. I was like, "Hey, you know, what's your experience with that stuff?" And he goes, "Oh, I don't know. I've never done it." So the fact that he had a T-shirt with this molecule, you know, blasting the name of this molecule, something that he himself hadn't experienced, it seemed to indicate that the DMT had sort of come on its own as a kind of character in the pharmacopoeia of culture and consciousness. And so it's sort of no accident, I think, that that the language and the discussion around this peculiar molecule has only increased since then, and it really pushes precisely on this question of the relationship of mind and matter, molecule, and consciousness. So I look forward to our conversation today very much. But first we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, the White Witch of Los Angeles, Maja Dawu. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. I, like you, am getting over a little bit of a cold. Maybe we should take some DMT and it'll clear our heads, huh?
It'll clear something. yes, Maja and I were both at in Las Vegas this last weekend. We were speaking at the Mysterium, which is a sort of alchemy workshop run by Jeff McBride, a performance magician who we've had here on Expanding Mind before. A great show if you're interested in. You can always, of course, check it out in the archive along with all the other shows we've had. It's quite a list. I don't know. Hey, Maj, have you like kind of looked at the list of all these characters we've talked to for the last couple years?
I did, because I was looking for some show to send a friend of mine, and I was going down, and I was like, oh my God, we've talked to so many great people.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, it's just almost like you have all of these sort of, you know, some of them have become friends, some of them are associates, peers, and it's like you look at the list, and it's like, my God, that's just the coolest party ever. I mean, it's sort of like my idea of like
party. A party, expanding mind party.
Exactly. It's like my idea of a good party is like we have, you know, like we have talking parties. You know, it's like there's like dancing parties, which are great too. But I've always been into talking parties where you get all the most voluble characters that you know and you put them together and people just bounce around. And so I like having some of that feel with the show. So today we'll go forward here and welcome Rick Strassman onto the show. Hey, Rick.
Good afternoon, Eric. How are you?
Very, very good. And you're in New Mexico?
Yes, I'm a few miles north of Taos, kind of near the Colorado border.
Very lovely area.
It's cold. It's windy. It's going to be snowing, it seems like, in a few hours.
Wow.
Still good, still good. So I'm kind of curious, I mean, when did DMT, the Spirit Molecule, the book, come out?
The book came out the end of 2000, around December 2000, January 2001.
So it's been a decade. How's that been for you? I mean, it's been a very interesting book, a very popular book. It's, you know, influenced the discussion. Things have happened in your life and in the life of the psychedelic scene, the expansion of research, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just curious now, looking back at it after 10 years, how you feel about the influence that this book has in terms of, you know, presenting to the world your story of the research you did there in New Mexico and the kind of findings you had and the speculations that that led to.
Well, you know, it's been a great book. I like to tell, you know, folks that I love the book and the book loves me. you know, it's been out 12 years now, pretty much. And, when did it come out? Yeah, it came out the end of 2000. So slightly over 11 years. Yeah, it's been selling more copies every year for the last, you know, 5 years or so. I think last week on Amazon it was ranked 1,200 overall on, you know, for their book sales. You know, so It's doing well. It continues doing even better. I think it's also been helped a lot by the release and distribution of the movie the last few months. That's increased interest in the book. And also the follow-up book, too, Inner Path to Outer Space, that I co-authored with three other, co-authors. It's you know, kind of gratifying, but also kind of curious as to the popularity of the book and of DMT. You know, I completed my studies in 1995, almost 17 years ago, and I gave my first dose of DMT in November of 90, over 20 years ago. You know, so in a lot of ways, it's old business, you know, for me anyway, the whole DMT story. At least from the point of view of the drug DMT, you know, the chemical compound, the pharmacology, those kinds of things. You know, one of the reasons I ended my studies in 95 was I just didn't feel I had a very good, you know, model to contextualize the experiences that people were having. It took a couple of years, you know, for me to decide that the kinds of states that people were entering into were spiritual in their nature. And so, in retrospect, I really didn't possess a good spiritual model for understanding and applying the kinds of experiences my volunteers were having. You know, so for the last, you know, umpteen years, I've been, you know, kind of, you know, working on the spiritual implications of you know, the existence of DMT in the human body and other places in the natural world, and you know, the implications of that.
Well, there's a couple of things that raises for me. One is just to, like, how since the book has come out, and even in terms of the argument that you make in the book, what do you now think about how DMT is located, where we find it in the body, and what mm-hmm. it does in terms of mediating certain kinds of states, and, you know, and particularly spiritual and, you know, death and dying.
Right, yeah. Well, so DMT was first discovered in a number of Latin American plants with, you know, psychoactive activity, especially the snuffs. And a number of years later, it was discovered in the brains and the blood of rodents. And then a few years after that, it was discovered in human body fluids like urine and spinal fluid and blood. You know, the majority of studies indicate that the lung is the major organ of DMT production. I speculate in the DMT book about the pineal gland, you know, being possibly a, you know, source of human and other animals, you know, DMT synthesis. And, you know, that's speculation. You know, it's, you know, based on you know, strong scientific data, but you know, terms of, you know, anybody actually discovering DMT in the pineal gland, that still hasn't happened.
Well, and it's important to say that, I think, because it seems to me in circles I've talked to, that's a big misconception, and a lot of people will misquote you on that and kind of take it as truth. And I'll hear all kinds of people in the, you know, New Agey ayahuasca circles, and they just full-on go ahead and say that it's formed in the pineal gland and has all this third eye ascribation and stuff like that, which, I mean, so how did your book spur? It was 12 years ago, and it did cause this kind of wave in terms of pineal gland stuff. Did anyone ever do any research into that you know of, like in terms of DMT being in that area?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. You know, a couple of months ago, an abstract was published in the Society of Neuroscience Proceedings. It was a group from Madison. You know, Nick Cozy is the main author, and in that abstract, they report some results of doing studies on the pineal glands of rhesus monkeys. And, you know, they demonstrate that there's quite high expression of the gene which is responsible for the enzymes which completes the synthesis of DMT in pineal gland.
Oh.
You know, so, you know, that's a very strong indication, you know, that there is, you know, formation of the gene anyway responsible for DMT synthesis in the pineal gland.
Right.
And, you know, what's incredibly amazing, too, is, you know, that they reported quite high activity of that gene in the retina as well.
Oh,
you know, so that kind of
high.
Opens up a whole can of worms. You know, is
yeah.
there DMT between the outside world and our visual perception of it?
Well, and just so the listeners know, I mean, part of the theory is there's this, you know, kind of metabolism that happens with tryptophan, melatonin, serotonin. They all kind of go back and forth, and then DMT is kind of involved in all that, too. So if I'm not mistaken, that was where you kind of speculated that. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Like I point out, the similarity in structure and in function between DMT and melatonin and serotonin.
Right.
You know, so both, you know, so all three compounds derive from tryptophan, you know, dietary tryptophan, and, you know, that's a ubiquitous amino acid, which is distributed through all of life.
Right.
And as, you know, Dennis McKenna likes to say, it's just a couple of trivial enzymatic steps between tryptophan and DMT.
Huh. And with the eyes, that's pretty crazy, because a lot of people have kind of, you know, think of DMT as being responsible for maybe the visions you see in dreams or hallucinations. So, I mean, what do you think about that kind of eye relationship with it?
Well, you know, the obvious, you know, implication is that DMT is, you know, mediating our, you know, visual world all of the time.
Wow.
Yeah, that, I never thought about that, of course, because we're, you know, there's that sort of marvelous fact that, you know, as far as the brain's concerned, basically what we're doing with our visual perception of the world in the waking state and in a dreaming state is essentially the same thing. It's just that, you know, in our waking state, we're getting feedback from some objective world that keeps the visions relatively, you know, consistent and engaged. And so there could really be like a widespread, you know, implication for the role of DMT and vision in general. But I'm also just sort of curious about that, about when, you know, you do scientific research, you have an interest in spirituality that becomes more pronounced, partly as a way to explain the experiences that people are going through, and partly through your own exploration. But it's a very unusual thing to approach spirituality, especially in an engaged, non-reductive way, through a kind of meditation on molecules. So what do you think it is about this approach, moving through molecular possibilities, the physical realities of the human nervous system, that sort of creates a different way of engaging traditions of meditation, traditions of afterlife, you know, ideas of the soul, those kinds of things? And so how has that kind of shaped your explorations of mm-hmm. the spiritual?
Well, yeah, well, so there's some good questions there. One thing, if we could, I would kind of like to return to the end of the first, you know, question that you asked about,
sure.
you know, the possible involvement of DMT in dreams and near-death states and those kinds of things. You know, that still remains to be determined. You know, we don't, you know if DMT increases during dreams or during the near-death state, or, you know, during meditation. It's extremely difficult, to measure the concentrations of DMT in the body, because the concentrations in the blood, for example, are, you know, down to the order of one billionth of a gram, per milliliter. You know, so the kind of technology that you need, you know, to just be able to detect it is extraordinarily complex. And, you know, to be able to compare normal levels with levels that occur in dream states or meditative states or near-death states is still slightly, you know, beyond the capacity of our current technology. You know, but we're closing in on it. And it also could be the case that the expression of, the genes is going to be a more accurate indicator of the production of DMT at specific times. So that's one of those questions whose answer remains to be determined. So getting back to your last question, it all kind of hinges on your definition of spiritual. There's a couple of issues that I, think are important when you're talking about spiritual. One of them is spiritual can refer to things, which are, mostly invisible. There's quite a few things that used to be invisible, but as a result of technology are no longer invisible. Up until the development of that technology, those invisible things, were considered spiritual entities. It's like germs, for example. You could see after the development of the microscope, and you could develop, physics of germs, whereas up until then it was, mostly the metaphysics of illness and, disease and those kinds of things. So I think of DMT as, possibly being a technology.
Well, that's really crazy. Sorry to interrupt you, but because the shamans who would take DMT were like doctors that would deal with the germs that were invisible, right? So it's almost like the DMT was like a microscope for the shamans to see what germs people had.
I believe it's a good analogy. If you can amplify or expand or extend, the receiving characteristics of, consciousness, through, modification of the chemistry of the brain, which is the organ of consciousness, then you could start perceiving things, which are otherwise, previously invisible.
Mm.
Some of those things could be external, and some of those, things could be internal. So that's, kind of where, things turn is, what is, the projection of our own psychology and, what is, the actual perception of external verities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where, kind of where one, determines the importance of inner work, kind of clarifying the lens or, clarifying the mirror, clarifying the window as much as you can in order to, be able to distinguish, what's your own projections, which you're perceiving under DMT and, what is, actually going on out there.
Well, that raises an interesting question for me is that, having had all this time within which to investigate other models and reports of spiritual practice, near-death experiences, et cetera, I'm curious how much you see of an overlap and how much you still kind of get a sense that there's something specific about the DMT experience in the sense that, as somebody who has read lots and lots of first-person accounts of all sorts of practices and things, I can see overlaps that some of which are very significant. But at the same time, there's also something very sort of peculiar and specific about DMT experiences on their own. Not so much in an ayahuasca brew where there's often more overlap with visionary, experiences in general. And I'm curious to see how all of your research into different kinds of spiritual practices and experiences, how you've come to sort of put DMT in relationship to them. Do you see it as a kind of umbrella background, embrace of all of these things, or is it just sort of is it a sub-realm, a specific kind of frequency that some people can access in other ways, but also doesn't necessarily have that much to do with other kinds of experiences people have?
Mm-hmm. DMT is unique because it's endogenous, to the human being, as compared to, let's say, LSD or, mescaline or, psilocybin or even salvia. So if, there were a spirit molecule out there or in there, you would think it would have to be a compound that the human body makes. So DMT, meets that criterion uniquely. And, so does bufotenine, so does 5-methoxy-DMT. Those are the three naturally occurring psychedelics, whose presence has been determined to occur in the human body. So I think that these compounds, well, especially DMT, can elicit a specific, kind of spiritual experience, like a specific channel or a specific category. I began my studies kind of steeped in the Zen Buddhist, tradition. I spent, 20 years studying under the supervision of a Zen community. And I was expecting, Zen enlightenment kinds of experiences in my volunteers, the unitive, ego-dissolving, union with all that is kind of states in the volunteers. And actually, those were quite rare. Maybe one out of 60 people had that kind of an experience. And even then, it was not as, classical as I was, expecting or kind of anticipating. You know, so I then started looking at spiritual models which, you know, take into account the more interactive, you know, maintenance of the ego, you know, the ability, you know, to willfully interact with the contents of the visions. And I've been, you know, looking into the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament's concept of prophetic states. And if you read about the states of consciousness and the spiritual experiences of the Old Testament prophets, you know, they were quite interactive. None of them described union with God or, you know, the merging into the white light, ecstasy or bliss or anything like that. You know, they're colorful, they're interactive, they argue, they bargain, they plead. There's all kinds of unpleasant and pleasant and all kinds of emotions. So I've been kind of, circling the concept of, you know, the Old Testament prophetic state of consciousness as a, you know, reasonable, you know, model.
Well, I encourage you to continue to do that. I mean, it reminds me on this show we had Jonathan Garb a while back who wrote a book about shamanism as a way to understand not the biblical era prophecy but later streams of Kabbalistic and Jewish mysticism. And I think that anyone looking at certain strands, both in the Hebrew Bible and also in some of the early Heckalot literature and stuff, will find, you know, strikingly similar phenomenologies, you know, angels with wings all over their eyes and fiery thrones and fiery serpents, and there's a lot of that very rich visionary material. And it's interesting, the question you had about how you came in there with the Zen background, with certain expectations about units of mysticism, is, you know, the more I study about mystical states, I have to kind of realize how much I come into with what you could call a perennialist bias, meaning that we kind of believe that there is sort of a kind of natural hierarchy of mystical states, and that in any given tradition, any part of the world, in any given context, you're going to kind of go in a certain direction. Whereas the more you look at it, the more you can generalize about certain things for sure, and you can find commonalities. Obviously, they're very powerful commonalities, but they're different. I mean, there's a different set of things, and in a way, giving up the attempt to reconcile them often helps us, I think, zero in on what is really specifically going on in this kind of stuff. But I'm curious, though, are you going to write about this? How are you working with the Hebrew materials?
Yeah, well, so I've been, you know, looking at the Hebrew Bible since around, you know, 1996 or so, and I retaught myself biblical Hebrew, and I've, you know, read all of, you know, the major commentaries, you know, to the text. So I've been, you know, working on a book for the last couple of years, which I kind of hope is going to be published, you know, by the end of this year, if everything goes according to plan. Yeah, so I'm comparing accounts of Old Testament prophetic states with the accounts, you know, from my DMT volunteers. And
wow.
I'm using the same categories of, you know, categorizing, you know, the states, you know, which I used in categorizing the experiences of my volunteers. You know, it's interesting. It's kind of a hodgepodge because I use the Buddhist Abhidharma psychology to characterize people's DMT experiences, and I'm kind of doing the same thing in, you know, comparing the DMT states to the prophetic states. You know, so I've completed about, you know, three quarters of the book, and it's you know, going to be published, you know, by the same publisher which has, you know, published the DMT books. It's a group called Inner Traditions. You know, so that's, you know, kind of where I'm you know, taking things, you know, these days.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, a lot of people will compare this kind of material, you know, with hallucinogens. They'll look at shamanic religion. They'll look at Eastern religions. But it's not that common that you'll find someone comparing it to such a standardized kind of traditional religion like Judaism or Christianity. I mean, there's a couple people, but it's really very rare. And I mean, there's so much stuff in the Bible with the prophets where they'll do, you know, specific techniques to get into altered states of consciousness. So it's not like an accident, you know, like you said, and they're actually trying to encourage that endogenous experience to happen inside their brain.
Yeah, and you know, you don't have to, you know, look under every rock and every stone, you know, in the Bible, you know, for like mushrooms or, you know, burning bushes or things. You know, if you just, you know, keep an eye on, you know, the natural, you know, formation of these compounds in the human body, you can stop, you know, looking, you know, for, you know, for plants and you know, for mushrooms in the Bible.
Which, well, you know, one would be greatly relieved by. that sort of the psychedelic literalism in the history of religions, I think, is really barking up the wrong tree after a certain, you know, there's some interesting little suggestions there, but it seems to make more sense that we're talking about something endogenous that can be produced through a whole variety of means rather than looking for, you know, physical plant substances and such.
But, yeah, well, you know, in you know, getting back to the comment about, you know, the techniques, you know, to induce prophecy, you know, strictly speaking, if you just focus on the Old Testament, you know, there really are no cases of anybody doing any specific techniques. You know, usually these are unbidden kinds of experiences. You know, so it's a completely, you know, different model than, you know, somebody who's interested in these states. Oftentimes, you know, the prophets complain and resist, and, you know, they would prefer not being, given these, you know, kinds of experiences. As compared to the Eastern model, you know, which oftentimes is a, you know, model of, you know, the seeker who's interested in attaining these specific levels of consciousness. And it's also, you know, like a Western model, too. It isn't Eastern, you know, it isn't an Eastern religion, and it isn't a, you know, jungle religion. It's, you know, one that derives out of our culture, our sacred book, those kinds of things. You know, so in, you know, some ways it's an attempt to psychedelicize the Bible, which I think, you know, ought to be out there as an option, you know, for people trying to understand their own, you know, psychedelic experiences, and also, you know, as a, you know, means of kind of establishing some, you know, scientific credibility, you know, to sacred Western texts.
Wonderful stuff. So, well, we have to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk with Mitch Schultz, the director of DMT, The Spirit Molecule, the documentary. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Daou on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou here with Eric Davis, and we're talking about DMT, the mystery contained in the molecule. And we were just wrapping up with Rick Strassman, author of DMT, Spirit Molecule. Now we're going to kind of shift gears a little bit here and go into more visual pursuits. We're going to talk with Mitch Schultz, who did the documentary on DMT, The Spirit Molecule. Hi, Mitch. How's it going?
Great. How are you guys doing today? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. We're good. So what brought you to DMT and kind of inspired you to make this documentary?
The short answer to that is an experience. It was a DMT experience back in 2002, and I was just getting ready to start my last year of school. And I had never even heard of the compound, anything about it whatsoever, and somebody was going to facilitate a session, and I was trying to explain that I had had other experiences and knew what to expect, and kind of just leading myself along and not having any idea, and his comment was either you do or you don't want to, and I dove in, and it was almost a second or two when I got back that I knew that I was going to make a movie. It was alarming to me on so many levels. It stopped me in my tracks. It changed everything from the way I walk down the street to how I communicate with people within relationships and just in general. So it was one experience, and after that experience, it really pushed me off onto just a set of research, and I just wanted to know everything I could about what this experience was and what this compound was, and then came across Dr. Strassman's book, of course, and I figured a way to tell the story. There was something about the science and the spirituality of me that really, you know, could ground it a little bit and make it a little bit more palatable for the masses, so to speak.
Well, I'm curious, what do you, when you reflect on it now, what do you think was it about your experience that changed you so much? I mean, I think that we can say that all kinds of experiences change some people and don't change other people that much. I mean, there's certainly
sure.
many people out there who have experimented with DMT and lots of other things, and they go, wow, it was really weird, what a trip, the world's a strange place. But they don't necessarily have the kinds of transformation that you're talking about, which is the kind of thing we associate more with, you know, with religious insight or spiritual transformation, where you see something and you can never really kind of go back for whatever reason. And it's, you know, I mean, there's a lot of other things to talk about, but it's just, that's a very interesting point for me. I often think about that because I get into this, when you're interested in the topic of psychedelics and spirituality, you got to face the fact that, like, for some people, even these very powerful, very otherworldly, very visionary experiences can also just be, you know, weird things to do on a weekend.
sure.
And yet for other people, they're clearly part and parcel of a really transformative path, sometimes because they bring that intention to the experience, but sometimes because it just happens. And that sounded like a little bit more like your style. You didn't expect. You were looking to change your life or your attitude or the way you walked down the street or the way you handled your relationships, but it happened. So I'm curious personally, like when you reflect on that now, after all the studies you've done, all the people you've talked to, what do you think's going on there?
Well, I think the big part of it was that it was a complete ego death, and everything, you know, the traditional report of everything shifting extremely quickly. There really was no in between space. It hits you a million miles an hour, and you're going through whatever it is, and I don't think anyone really knows. We can sit here and speculate, but I saw everything that I thought I knew what the world was made of, how it interacted, you know, on my very subjective level, but it shattered all of that, and it made me open up to the fact that, you know, there's a lot more out there, and not necessarily if this is a truly spiritual separate space altogether, but just that the mind itself can build up these barriers or parameters or just models that seem to dissipate really quickly and gave me a sense or at least an openness of something else and really humbling more than anything. It really just brought me back to, you know what, you really don't know anything. and it did just that. It just reminded me, or told me very, very clearly that I really had no idea.
And do you mind if I ask, like, what was the source of the type of DMT you took? Was it ayahuasca or something different?
No, it was the extracted form, and it was, you know, this was actually stuff that was purchased prior to DMT being illegal off of a website. It was an extremely potent crystal. It was a smoked version of DMT. So it hits, you know, within 30 seconds, sometimes a little bit longer, but lasts for 5 to 10 minutes, maybe 15. And that was the other thing about it, was just the quickness and how fast everything happened.
Well, and that's one of the reasons I asked you, and like Dr. Strassman had mentioned the bufotenin, which is one of my favorite sources, and because I'll talk to different people, and I'm sure you have too, that'll have different sources of it and different kinds, and it'll do different things, and that one's always interesting to me because that's the one that comes from the toads, you know, and a lot of times when it's a crystallized form of the extract, the source of it'll be from the toad skin, which is just fascinating to me. But do you feel like, have you done it with other ones and it wasn't that crazy, or was that like first kind of crystallized one the kind of most transformative that you had?
Well, yeah, there have been a few other times that it wasn't transformative in any way. It was more playful and just kind of bright, pretty colors. You know, and the 5-methoxy and the thought and just open up a whole different realm because the experience is completely different. And a lot more like a traditional, you know, what people would say is a Godhead experience. But yeah, I think they're different. They're the variations. I think a lot of times it's, you know, where the compound is getting extracted from, who's doing the extraction, what sort of chemicals and things that they're using to pull the compound out of there. And then also, you know, similar to what Eric was saying, there's that intention or that set and setting on the front end of this that can have a huge impact on what the experience is.
Mm.
Can make it frightening, and it can make it a very blissful and beautiful experience.
Yeah, it's a really a weird mix. I mean, one of the things that's happened over the last, say 25 years, as people have become more interested in DMT and in ayahuasca, a lot of people have been searching for other organic sources of DMT, and it turns out that they're all over the place, and that they're, in fact, DMT is widely distributed in the plant kingdom, and some very, high concentrations are found in, let's say, certain varieties of acacia trees and such, and that more and more sources now are organic. They're linked to directly to plant extractions, whereas the kinds of things that were done with the first wave of experimentalists and doctors back before it was scheduled were often synthetic forms. And then, like Mitch says, it totally depends on the framework. I just talked to a friend who was back from Australia, where there is a kind of form of smokable DMT that's called changa, that is derived from plants, and it has a sort of slightly different character than the kind of synthetic synthesis that we've been talking about. But you find it in different worlds. Like, so there are people who have a very sacred attitude towards it, the people who would go see a shaman in an ayahuasca circle. But then there's also people who are just like, it's just around, and it's like you can watch TV and it makes it weirder, and it's a very strange thing about these compounds, about how on the one hand they can seem so profound and so sacred, and then but then there's these other sides to it, and it's not always clear how much of it is our intention, our psychological set. Sometimes I think people get too involved in thinking about the compound or the molecule as being the sort of key, when it's really, in some ways, but not in all ways, something that's much more about the self. So, but just, I just want to, talk about your documentary a little bit. I mean, it's doing very well. I've just let people know I was one of the people interviewed for it, and a couple of weeks ago or a month ago or so, I was flooded with comments because I guess it had achieved some sort of Netflix. I don't do Netflix, so I'm not sure, but it was like, the sort of, movie of the week or whatever the heck it was, and everybody watched it and everybody bounced back. So that was a good sign. You seem to have passed a certain tipping point.
It's really been amazing how quickly this thing has taken off. We actually launched it digitally, which is kind of the VOD route, iTunes and cable providers, in October, and then they hold back on the Netflix. And within the first week of being out on iTunes, we shot up to the third spot in the indie list and also the documentaries. And, there is this built-in community and audience that is there, but I keep finding that there are new people coming to this information every day. And especially, I crafted, or at least tried to craft, the film that, even though it came out, it might seem a little biased, but really playing and trying to open it up to other people and not preach to the choir as much. But it did. It's taken on a life of its own. When it hit Netflix, it was the top watched movie that day or the few days, and it just continues to get bigger. We're going to be launching internationally shortly, and hopefully by the end of the year have it out worldwide.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on the nitty gritty, but I do know that, since obviously the media markets are transforming so drastically, and it must be a very confusing thing, even from the moment you started shooting it to when you're finished, about how to bring it to people. Could you just say a little bit about how you decided to go with a digital release? Like, how, especially with documentaries, there's so many documentaries out there. Clearly, the path you chose was a good one. So what was it about that kind of digital distribution that seemed to make sense to you?
Well, I think the traditional film model is if it isn't, it's pretty much dead at this point. Theatrical, and even DVDs for that matter, are just going away. quicker than anything. And obviously the digital realm is the way to go. And it's the way to hit the largest amount of people. And I really feel, you know, not just from a filmmaker perspective, like I want to get this film out there and have it seen by everybody. I just think there's a lot of good content in there for people to try to wrap their heads around. And the digital aspects seem the best way to go and hit the widest amount of people. And, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, we had a lot of time to make the film, and so I had a lot of time to do some research as we were putting everything together and trying to get a sense of, you know, what was the best way to launch this thing. And we first started selling DVDs on our own, and that was what really got the distributor's attention. We had quite a few that were interested and ended up going with a company called Gravitas. And ultimately, it was Warner Brothers that distributed the film.
Great. And you have a remix project in mind that you're debuting soon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's after going through the footage, we started shooting, shot most of our interviews in 2007. We shot roughly 50 interviews, and amazing interviews, like yourself, and we just had great people to talk to about a lot of these different concepts. We used 1%, I think, of our interview footage in the entire film. So there was so much more that I wish I could have had in there. If I could have made this a 20-hour film, I would have, but my editor kept reminding me that that wasn't going to be the case. So I, you know, sitting here looking at all this footage, it just felt like a waste for that to sit in my vault. So what we've come up with is to do a remix project, like you said, and to put all this footage out there via, you know, non-commercial Creative Commons, let people go out and watch it, share it, make it into new films, put it into music, any way that they can. And we really want to use this as a source for even in universities. I think it should be part of a curriculum. People should be talking about this a little bit more and at least trying to, you know, understand what some of this could be. And it's not even about psychedelics. It's more about consciousness, I think, and trying to understand that there's a world that's not just this physical space.
Did you have a favorite person that you were able to interview with that really just kind of blew your mind about it?
Eric Davis.
Oh, boy.
Well, I had to say it, man. Well, you know, it's hard to answer that question. I do get that often. Each one of them brought something that was completely different and unique, and I think I was able to take something away from each one of them. You know, sitting down and talking to Houston Smith was a blessing. Talking to Dennis McKenna, Charles Grobe. I could just go on and on. It really was a fantastic group of people, and again, just brought different stuff every time. And that's one of the reasons for the remix project. I want to be able to share that with the rest of the world and see how people respond to this stuff.
Did you get any flack from anybody about it, where people were just like pissed about it or anything like that?
There's been some pushback a little bit. And it is a tricky and kind of it's a fine line to walk, of course, when you're dealing with a substance that's highly illegal. And then you're also at the same time calling out spiritual experiences from ingesting these compounds. It can definitely rub people the wrong way. And I think for the most part, people have been very happy with what it is, or at least interested to explore. But there's been a little bit of pushback here and there, and mainly from, I would say, the religious community. But I did kind of expect that. But, you know, my response is, and I use my father as a sounding board while I was making this film, a very conservative, traditional man in the States, and I just kept saying, you know, what's the interesting part about this? And he said the fact that this compound is everywhere, because no matter what side of the fence you sit on, there, that's got to at least raise a few questions as to why this compound is all over nature and why it's in our body. And so we tried to, you know, play with that and use that, and I think, you know, even those that have had a little bit of pushback, once we kind of go that route and start talking about, you know, the ubiquity of DMT everywhere, there's a step back and people are a little more open to listening.
So, how has it inspired you in terms of where you see your next moves? Do you want to keep working with this material in different ways? Do you want to make more documentaries in this space? Like, how has it changed, this very long process, very exhausting process, and clearly a rewarding one for you now. How is that shaping your sense of the next step?
Well, I'm working now on, or as I was going through all this footage, conceived of a four-part, what I'm calling a manifesto of how people, or how humanity can reconnect with spirit, however you understand that. So the first part is consciousness being connected to spirit with the DMT. the next part is, you know, once we have that kind of quantum awareness, how are we coming back into the physical world and putting those things into practice? You know, how are we growing food? How are we treating animals? How are we treating one another? The third part is going to be the celebration of spirit, and that's going to be through international music and looking at the computer as the first global folk instrument, where these musicians around the world are sharing their mythologies and traditional music through the electronic realm. And then the last part is going to be about language and mythology and how we could hopefully modify and rewrite a modern mythology.
We'll talk more a little bit about that. Like, what role do you see these compounds playing in precisely that? I mean, do we need a modern mythology? What does it look like? You know, how does it draw from the past? Is it new? What are some thoughts on that question of modern myth?
Well, I think it's important to really look back at all the ancient knowledge, from the major religions, but all the way to some of the more esoteric stuff that's out there. I think they all have kernels of truth in them, and you know, these beautiful metaphors and ways of looking at the world that have definitely served us well, but at the same time have started to fail us. And I think, you know, kind of our modern sped up technological world is giving us a different sense of what reality is and what it could be, and really giving us new opportunities to explore that. So I think it's important to look back at these other traditions and give them credence, but also start to look at what these new things that are coming up through technology, through politics, life and quantum physics, and just the different ways that we're starting to be able to view the world in general, but also looking back at the past and pulling from those as well.
One of the interesting things about DMT and people's descriptions of it, in particular the descriptions of the visual quality of it and the sense of space, of a kind of geometry, a kind of non-Euclidean geometry, is that the way people talk about it, it sometimes seems like they're talking about, you know, databases and, you know, computer models of, you know, n-dimensional reality. And there's this very weird way in which it kind of resonates with certain potentials and aspects of the technological landscape. I mean, I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons that DMT became kind of more of a charismatic character in the early 1990s, even though it had been known among the, you know, psychedelic explorers since the 60s, is that there's a weird way in which it resonates with our kind of contemporary space and the visuals of it and some of the remarkable visuals that people have done, you know, inspired by it. I mean, from YouTube videos to the amazing graphics in that funny Western Renegade to some of the stuff that you play with in your documentary. There's a strange way in which we're, like, our computers are giving us the capacity, and not just computers, but sound and immersive sound and light experiences, to create very, very rich analogs that are kind of inspired or model or resonate with some of these internal experiences. And that's another one of those answers to people who are kind of freaked out about this stuff. You know, one is that, like, hey, DMT is everywhere. You know, maybe there's a reason for that. You know, it fits like a, you know, lock in a very nice keyhole in our brains, but, or in our whole nervous systems and our whole beings. But also is that the kind of intensity, the kind of whirlwind, the kind of data density, the sort of emerging languages, the sense of a kind of otherworldly space is something that, in some sense, our technology is also driving us towards, whether we want it to or not. And I'm sure you've thought about some of these things, especially when it came to thinking about some of the graphics for the documentary and some of the events that you're involved with now. So how do you see this stuff as playing a role in inspiring, you know, the new folkloric tool of the computer?
Well, and it's funny you bring that up. Well, not funny, but I do remember in our interview talking just about that and the model, or at least having this kind of more technological model to wrap our heads around what that experience is and this, you know, heavy amount of data and speed and things running a million miles an hour compared to what was happening in the 60s, which was a totally different experience through LSD and a mind frame that could handle or deal with that experience on a different level. And I think there is a lot to that the world that we're in now and the speed and the amount of interaction and connectivity that we have definitely plays a role in that. And with regards to the computer being used to kind of create these experiences, it was really interesting in the scape of the film that my visual artists or my compositors and 3D guys had never touched a psychedelic in their life. And so having to go in and try to explain what that world is, what happens, the shifts in space and time, the ego death, the amount of data that's coming at you, was really interesting. But being able to use that computer as a filter, we were able to, I think, come close, but at least give a sense of what that is, because I don't think you can ever fully register what that experience is like just on a two-dimensional screen. But the computer definitely gave us an opportunity to push the boundaries on that.
Yeah, very much so. So you're having an event in Austin this coming up, right?
We are. We're going to kick off South by Southwest Interactive with the DMT Remix project, and we'll be doing a full event for that and having different artists that are going to be involved in the Remix project and using some of the footage and just releasing it to the world, letting people know that this data is out there. You can go out and you can play with it. You can explore it, educate, and that's going to be the big kickoff for the event or for the project. And we're looking forward to kind of getting that out there and sharing it with the world.
Excellent. So if folks are in the Austin area, you can find out about it through the website, DMT, you know, it's the spiritmolecule.com. Is there any other places folks can find out more information about you and the project?
Sure. Well, the DMTRMX.com is going to be the host site for the project. We also are going to be broadcasting or streaming the event live during the event, so it'll be starting at 4 o'clock on the 9th, Central Time, that is, 4 o'clock p.m., and probably going until 2 a.m. So we'll have a link and all that information that's going to be on the DMT Facebook page as well as the DMT RMX site and the Spirit Molecule. So if anybody would like to go to any of those places, there'll be plenty of information about the project and about the streaming of the event.
Wonderful.
Would love for people to tune in.
Okay. Well, Mitch, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much for having me, and look forward to chatting, well, I guess maybe next Friday, Eric.
That's right. All right. Well, from Maja and me, to all our listeners, keep your minds open.